AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season is a year-round event. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, guys.
We've lost Joanna, who's off in Los Angeles because she can just jet down to L.A. whenever she wants. That's how California works.
I believe she drives, actually.
No, well, jet in a car.
Those beautiful, picturesque highways.
Yeah. So at the end of this episode, we're going to share an interview that I did with Rebecca Skloot and Rose Byrne. Rose is an actor in the HBO movie The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and it is based on Rebecca Skloot's book. And Rose Byrne actually plays Rebecca Skloot, and this is the first time I think I've interviewed a person and then the person who plays them in a movie, which is a really interesting, surreal experience. And
That's cool.
They look alike, which you don't necessarily expect for an author, because who knows what an author looks like? They could have done whatever.
You should have brought an actor to play you.
I know. Very
Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah, or you guys could have pretended to be me and I could have hidden behind a screen.
Hi, I'm Katie Rich.
Yeah, it's a very meta experience, but a very good interview. That movie airs on HBO this weekend, and we've talked about the incredibly competitive miniseries TV movie contest at the Emmys this year, and that's just going to throw its hat right in the ring.
Well, there's this up-and-coming young actress named Oprah Winfrey who's in that,
yes,
right?
Yes, I hear she has a lot of promise.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's a shame she doesn't have the star power to really muscle her way into an awards race. But before we get into that, we want to talk a little bit more about more television. The Leftovers came back also on HBO over the weekend, and it's one of those shows that it feels like critics are constantly pulling you by the collars and being like, watch this show, like The Americans. And it hasn't worked on me. I haven't watched it. But Richard, it's the last season.
I don't know. Is that true? Because the first season, I feel like, was very critically up and down.
It was the second season that really did
second
it.
Second season.
Yeah. So the show premiered in 2014, the first season. And it was, you know, people were like, oh, it's interesting. It's based on a novel by Tom Perata. And I think the first season is basically the novel's story.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, 2% of the world's population disappears. All of a sudden, was it the rapture? And are the people who are left behind kind of like damned, you know, whatever. So it's an interesting premise. Kind of, I think, all about, well, grief and depression. And so it's heavy stuff. So that first season, didn't quite. You know,
there's a lot of Liv Tyler smoking like Marlboro Light 100s.
As a cult member, these kind of people who smoke cigarettes and wear all white.
You had a lot of affection for it then, too.
I did, yeah. I mean, I thought it was stylistically really interesting. You know, it has this beautiful Max Richter music, and the cast, Justin Theroux, Carrie Coon, Amy Brenneman, Liv Tyler, are all really good in it in that first season. So it was enough to get me to watch,
and
you know.
Justin Theroux also did a fair amount of shirtless sort of jogging and things like that.
I don't know what you're implying.
I mean, we've got that body. Like, I mean, it'd be ashamed to wear a
shirt.
You
got it flaunted.
Yeah, that show is called Jennifer Aniston is a Lucky Woman.
So then it came back for the second season.
So then it came back for the second season, and it just had this different vibe about it. The first season took place in upstate New York, and then at the beginning of the second season, it had already really relocated to this kind of like religious site, small town in Texas, with a lot of the main cast still intact, but then also new cast members like Kevin Carroll and Regina King kind of adding to the mix. And, you know, as the episodes 1, 2, 3 of the second season played out, you kind of saw on Twitter like critic-y types being like, wait, what's going on with this show? And then by the end of that season, and people were, myself included, speaking like, well, no pun intended, rapturously about, because it was just this beautifully inventive and weird artistic, like it's a beautiful piece of art, that second season of The Leftovers, and the acting is phenomenal. There's this especially great scene between Regina King and Carrie Coon where they basically, one gives a monologue and then the other gives one back, and it's like just this incredible tete-a-tete that, you know, had that show had a higher profile in its first season and then the second season used that momentum. I mean, that would have been like Emmy gold there. But
didn't that season also open with like a flashback to a cave woman or something
to, like,
really wild?
Tens of thousands of years ago. That was the first sequence in the second season is that. And so that was an immediate announcement of like, oh, they're going to do something a little bit bigger than this domestic thing.
We're saying that the show is created and I guess executive produced by Damon Lindelof, who was one of the main movers behind Lost and really went through the ringer with both making a show that people loved and going head to head with the fans and kind of getting constant feedback from people telling him what his show should be and really struggling with that to the point that he kind of quit Twitter for a while. And with The Leftovers season one, there was all this negative feedback that it seems like it had an impact on him. And then somehow he came back for season two and now season three galvanized and really able to do what he wants to do.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, like I said, my understanding, I haven't read the book, is that the first season of the show really kind of ends where the novel ends. Mm-hmm. And so then he and Tom Perrotta, who is credited as a co-creator on the show, just were like, okay, so where does this story go now? And it turns out it gets more expansive and a lot more kind of existential and metaphysical. And, you know, you see a lot of what Damon Lindelof brought to Lost in this show, these kind of seemingly random asides that then actually turn out to be, you know, so they have some sort of grand significance later on, jumps back in time or forward in time in some cases, that worked really beautifully on Lost. But when on a 22 episode, you know, season, you know, first over six seasons, like, Lost got very cluttered and hard to kind of resolve. But with The Leftovers, where it's a hard out after three seasons, this current season's the new one is only eight episodes, like maybe this is where Lindelof's kind of, you know, erratic and sort of grandiose storytelling actually can work because he has these limits imposed upon him. I don't know. I'm hoping that that's the case. I've seen seven of the eight episodes of season three, and it's very different than season two, but I'm into it.
Well, isn't that what we keep learning with these new structures of television, like Big Little Lies or like The Leftovers? It's like when someone is given a limited amount of television and then free reign, they're just able to do so much more. Like, it makes me really intrigued for what's going to happen with Twin Peaks when it comes back, because David Lynch was working on network television in a basically different universe, and what can he do when he's got a more budget and, you know, eight episodes to play with?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that people will go back and watch the seasons prior if they haven't already seen them, and then tune into season three. But I do want to say to the people who already have seen season two and loved it, just be prepared that this is a different season of television. The tone is different. It's a lot funnier. It's a lot more antic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's still steeped in like really sad stuff, but like, it's kind of more of an adventure.
Okay.
They go to like the Australian outback and are kind of in search of something, and it's I mean, it has these kind of sad digressions, but like it's a lot more plot heavy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Huh. How about if you haven't watched the first two, can you just watch it?
Oh, I think you would have no idea what was going on.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like I've been told that I could start in season two if I
You could start in season two, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is where I was thinking.
And just read like a plot synopsis of season one. There would be a couple things that would be confusing, but yeah, so my hope is that, you know, a lot of times we've talked about the Emmys kind of running a year or two behind. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that because season two is so revered, that even if season three isn't as good, that this show will pick up some accolades just based on the strength of season two. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think season three is good, but you know, because Carrie Coon again is amazing. Amy Brenneman in season three just gives this incredible performance where it's like, where has she been for the past, you know, I don't know how long, since Judging Amy or wherever. It's just like they find really cool things to do with really good actors. So,
Well, you talk about that scene with Carrie Coon and Regina King, and Regina King has won back to back Emmys for American Crime. So you'd think that some Emmy glow could rub off on her. I don't think it works that way, but it does seem like Carrie Coon is making her way with the kind of performance that Regina King had on a show that, you know, people were watching but not paying that much attention to, but like she just kind of pulled the spotlight to herself. So maybe Carrie Coon could do the same thing.
Yeah, I think this could be a big year for Carrie Coon. We've mentioned before because she has this in Fargo. So, and she seems like a good person. And, you know, so I'm rooting for her.
Yeah, we'll talk about Fargo next week when Joanna's back. So she is the resident Fargo.
She absolutely is. I have to write a review today of what I've seen of the new season. And it's like, I wish that I had sort of Joanna's like intense fan knowledge. You know, I wish I was.
It's not just
that.
What have you done to Ewan McGregor, like written 100 times.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you seen the shots of Ewan McGregor in the new season of Fargo?
Oh, no.
He's got like a pot belly and like long hair with like a bald pad. He looks awful and almost unrecognizable.
Really?
Yeah. But you know,
interesting.
I know, it's
we'll get
intriguing.
Into it next week.
And, yeah, we'll talk about it next week. Well, and also by next week, we will have gotten to the backside of the Tribeca Film Festival,
which
kicks off here in New York. I guess today, as you're listening to this, it's in our neighborhood. It's, you know,
it is,
neighbors
which is great,
of Tribeca,
which is nice. Yeah.
And Richard, as our film critic, you're the one who we send out to bring back to us what's interesting that Mike and I are too locked in the office to actually go see movies. So, what's that Tribeca that you're intrigued by? And saying that a lot of things that premiere Tribeca will show up on VOD in shortly. theatrically or in theaters. So, you know, things that are in Tribeca now will likely be available everywhere or close to everywhere pretty soon.
Yeah. I mean, Tribeca is an interesting festival. I think we talked about this last year, that it's a little bit sort of trying to still find its identity. It's only 16 years old, which is, you know, about a third of the age of Sundance, a little less than that.
Cannes turning 70 this year.
Right. Cannes is 70. You know, so actually, no, Sundance is about 30 years old. So half the age. But, you know, I think one thing that Tribeca has focused on recently, very smartly, is documentaries. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of good stuff, or seemingly good stuff, coming up in that front. I'm most excited personally for Whitney, Can I Be Me, a documentary about Whitney Houston. Yeah. I think, you know, that's a fascinating and tragic, but also at times joyous story about one of the best singers of the last, you know,
who did they
long.
Get the participation of? Because her family is so all over the place.
You know, I'm not actually sure, which is one thing that makes me more curious. I actually don't really know much about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether it's going to be a really deep dive or if it's going to be kind of testimonial from people who worked with her or whatnot. So I'm really curious about that. There's also a Clive Davis documentary. So there's a lot of music stuff happening.
Yeah, and that's the opening night, Clive Davis.
That is. So yeah. They're kind of really touting that. They're going to do a big concert. I think Aretha Franklin's performing. Wow. Earth, Wind, and Fire, I think, is performing. Like, it's a really big kind of an event, which is a good kickoff for the festival. You know?
Yeah.
And then there's this documentary that I'm not really sure why anyone would watch it, called I Am Heath Ledger, about him. I mean, you know, it's an interesting story, but again, like, oof.
Yeah, Heath Ledger and Whitney Houston in one film festival. That's a lot of tragic deaths.
That could be an intense double bill.
I Am Heath Ledger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that like, well, that makes me think it's a lot of his footage or footage of him.
They have the participation of his family. They're, you know, his sister, I think, is doing interviews. So it seems like a pretty intimate look there. I mean, the cult, you know, personality around Heath Ledger is pretty intense. He's been dead almost 10 years.
Yeah. For subjects recent enough, something's happened in documentary where you can actually stitch together footage of basically every important moment in their lives if you put in enough effort.
Well, you think about the Amy Winehouse documentary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which
yeah.
in some ways it was like, oh, so soon, but they actually, I mean, that was a beautiful, tragic movie, you know?
Yeah.
That won an Oscar.
I think Cameron Crowe made a Pearl Jam documentary.
I think so, yeah.
And that was the first time I remember where I was just like, oh. Like, if you look around enough, and that was even before phones, it was just people, there was always some person with a, like, camcorder at everything. You can basically tell the whole story if you just take the time.
If you can find that stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
I just read, it does look like that a lot of the footage in the Heath Ledger is that stuff he shot himself. Also, like Montage of Heck, the Kurt Cobain documentary, which was a lot of footage from their, you know, crazy days. And Courtney.
I'm going to sound crazy, but Justin Bieber Never Say Never is a pretty good concert documentary with a lot of footage of him backstage. I mean, he's another pop culture icon.
I'm going to take your word for that.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to check it out.
But I did look at Ewan McGregor's pictures from Fargo.
Oh, there we go.
He looks awesome, I think, in my opinion.
Okay. Better than ever.
That was just a little aside. Mm-hmm.
All right, what's maybe less tragic at Tribeca?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if it's not tragic. It might be kind of alarming. One of the bigger narrative entries at the festival is The Circle, the new movie from James Ponsoldt, based on the Dave Eggers book, starring Tom Hanks and Emma Watson. It's a story about a Google/Facebook, as mostly Google-esque company, its overreach, even for its employees, like into their lives. It just starts to get more and more troubling, and, you know, it escalates as it goes. It's a thriller. And when I read the book a few years ago, I saw, you know, my dad had recommended it to me, saying like, oh, you know, this gets a lot right. And I was like, oh, you're just being an alarmist old man. And I read the book and I was like, yeah, this is all. And now it's kind of like, a lot of this has come to pass in just a few years. So it's all about kind of surveillance and like what you share willingly with the world and the internet and who owns that information. And that could be interesting.
The Circle looks so good on paper, and I hate to be that person that says release date is everything, but it makes me wonder that it's coming out in the spring. It's premiering Tribeca and opening about like a week or two later. I don't know. I mean, I've loved everything James Ponsoldt's ever made, so
but
I don't want to.
This wanna... is an odd.
It's an odd choice for
him.
Yeah.
I mean, his last movie was the wonderful
The End of the Tour.
The End of the Tour with Jason Segel.
Former guest on Little Gold Men.
That's exactly right. And this is such a weird tonal. I mean, I guess working on a movie about David Foster Wallace and then adapting a book by Dave Eggers, like there's a commonality.
Clear line there.
Boy literature.
Into Gen X geniuses.
Yeah. Right.
Literary geniuses.
I mean, I am excited to see John Boyega in not a Star Wars movie, because he kind of had his big breakthrough. I mean, he was amazing in Attack the Block like 5 years ago, but now he's very famous as Finn. Huh. So I'm hoping for good things from him there.
And an Oscar connection also in the movie is young Eller Coltrane from Boyhood, who we watched grow up.
Yay. Yeah. Love Eller Coltrane.
Yeah. So we'll see how he does in that. You know, I'm also curious, like, it's 2017 and the movies still have a hard time talking about the internet. you know, or showing it in any sort of compelling way.
I saw The Fifth Estate. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, The Fifth Estate looked like something from like 1994. It was like, what is this? So, I mean, I think that like obviously,
well, you know, in fairness, the Soviet propaganda ministers requested a lot of changes on that.
That's true. That's right. Fair. Yeah. A lot of notes.
Yeah.
So past that, you know, then we get into some kind of more eclectic territory because, you know, that's kind of the nature of this festival. I'm really curious about two potential comeback-y kind of things. One is which a movie called Love After Love with Annie McDowell, who plays a kind of newly widowed woman. You know, Annie McDowell has been doing a cable television show for a few years, something Cove, I think. But she hasn't really been doing a lot of movies. So this could, except for, excuse me, Magic Mike XX.
Which she was great in.
She was really good in that.
Cedar Cove.
Cedar Cove, yes. Thank you. On the Hallmark Channel, I believe.
IMDb is not revealing that information.
So that could be interesting just to see her in like a little indie drama. You know, we have not seen her in that vein in a long time. And then we have Dog Years with Burt Reynolds.
Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, about a former movie star who is getting ready to get a Lifetime Achievement Award. So, you know, Burt Reynolds is somebody who has had a comeback already when he was in Boogie Nights and got an Oscar nomination and didn't win.
And did not take it well as the GIF evidence proves.
No, he did not. And then he kind of went away again after doing a couple other movies. But now this, I don't know, this could be another thing. It's, again, talking about meta, this feels very meta, you know?
Yeah.
There was a great feature on him in Vanity Fair a couple years ago. I'm trying to look up the exact date. November of 2015, Burt Reynolds isn't broke, but he's got a few regrets. So if you want kind of the update for the context of a comeback vehicle for him, it's a good read.
Read that, then go see this movie or wait for it to be on demand or wherever
it's going to be. Yeah, obviously you want to see movies in theaters, but kind of the interesting way that festivals have been going is if it's not Manchester by the Sea, that a lot of these movies will wind up on VOD. Like the Sundance Audience or a Jury Award winner, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. Like it's on Netflix now.
It's on Netflix now, that's right. So yeah, that's kind of what I have my eye on.
Well, and not to... you know, continue to confirm my reputation as the childless dad of VF.com. But the trip to Spain, I'm excited for the trip to Spain.
Oh my God, how could I forget the trip to Spain? Yeah.
I mean, the second trip movie was not as good as the first trip movie, but
it was still good.
They're still pretty good. I mean, there's like, there's nothing wrong with hanging out for 2 hours with those two.
Well, I was going to say, what's this one about? But I'm just guessing it's eating food in Spain.
I think eating food in Spain. I would guess.
Yeah, if you can't make it to, you know, Mediterranean Europe this summer, this spring, like watch that movie.
And Coogan kind of and Bryden cringe at Coogan's sex life, and cringe at Bryden's puns, and you know, and look at all the food. It's fun.
Yeah, I was lucky 2 years ago when the trip to Italy came out, and you know, they're at all these beautiful sun splashed places having lovely food, and I felt really jealous and wanted to go, and then I got to go to Cannes like 2 weeks later.
There you go.
So that's a great one, Mike, that I had forgotten about. That's exciting. And then they're also doing a kind of special screening with a panel for, have you guys heard of these movies, The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2?
Mm. I don't know.
Yeah.
They got a couple of Italians in them.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so Robert De Niro obviously is one of the founders of the festival, and so they're doing a retrospective on those two films.
I love how they left out 3, too. They're just like...
they're like, yeah, we're not gonna.
Even we know that wasn't good.
Yeah, because like, De Niro's not in one, either, so it's not like they're doing the De Niro ones.
Andy Garcia was waiting by the phone.
Nope,
sorry, dude.
Well, they're showing both movies back-to-back, right? So you can just watch one and two. That would be a really good... I mean, it's long. You're in theater a long time.
6-hour.
Just imagine just like focusing and being immersed in that world for so long.
But seeing it on a big screen would be fun. I mean, I don't do a lot of that kind of like when they revive things, but I went to a Lincoln Center. They're doing a retrospective on the Steadicam earlier this year, and I went to see The Shining on the big screen, which I'd never seen.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you get the opportunity, it can be really cool.
Yeah.
And I heard Brando's going to come in as a hologram for the Q&A.
Oh, great. Yeah. Because he recorded hours and hours of hologram footage of himself when he was filming Dr. Moreau.
Probably did.
Yeah, I Am Marlon Brando. That documentary's on its way.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Pretty good. I like that a lot better than your Trump, actually.
Oh, really?
It's more pleasant. Well, there will be coverage from you and a lot of our staff on VF.com.
Yeah, a lot of the other staff, Johanna Desta, Laura Bradley, will be covering. There's a lot of panels and kind of
talks, which is one of the best things Tribeca does, I think. Yeah. They get really great talent and interesting people talking
to each
other.
Well, because the talent doesn't have to be up in the goddamn mountains. It's in New York City.
Over the coast of France.
Yeah, it's easy to get to. So we will have some coverage. And hopefully, you know, there is always one surprise or not. I think Always Shine was a nice surprise. surprise for you last year.
Yeah, I really liked that movie.
You know, I've seen some interesting things.
All this panic, which I guess I think I'm quoted on the poster. I write very few reviews these days, but that one keeps coming back.
I'm excited to see my annual Jessica Biel project. Mm. This time it's a television show that's screening, so she's always got something to try back.
You know, she's got that children's restaurant, so she's got to have some kind of side hustle.
Oh, fudge, you mean?
Oh, fudge, yes.
Yeah, someday. The last time I went to California, the last time I went to LA, the plane was ascending from LA, like, you know, I'm on my way home, and it jumped on my head. I was like, oh, I forgot to go to Oh Fudge. So next time.
You wait till my baby is old enough to eat at Oh Fudge, and we can all make a trip of it. Because you have to have a kid, otherwise you get arrested.
Or maybe Bill will do a pop-up at Tribeca next year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you never know what's going to happen at Tribeca.
That's true.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
And now we're going to share my conversation with Rebecca Skloot, the author of the book The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and Rose Byrne, who plays Rebecca Skloot in the upcoming HBO movie version of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca Skloot's book was published in 2010, and it's about this woman, Henrietta Lacks, whose cervical cancer cells were taken by doctors at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore without her knowledge or permission, and then were found to be self-replicating outside of her body, which made them, in the terms they call it, immortal. And those cells have since been used for research on everything from the polio vaccine to cancer to AIDS treatment. And Henrietta Lacks was this incredibly important figure in medical research who very few people knew about. And Rebecca Skloot went and investigated her story and met her family members. Her daughter in the movie is played by Oprah Winfrey. And then this movie kind of shows the journey that she went on to find this incredible true story. So now listen to Rebecca and Rose talk about the experience of making the movie. So I'm here with Rebecca Skloot, the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and Rose Byrne, who plays Rebecca Skloot in the movie The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Thank you both for sitting here in the studio with me.
Thanks for having us.
I just want to hear, to start with, the first time you guys met, and, you know, I assume that you knew that, Rose, you would be playing Rebecca in the movie. So what was that meeting like?
We Skyped, I believe. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was a I think we Skyped. We, like, texted and organized to Skype, and it was, you know, Skypes are funny and awkward, and and also I was very eager to see Rebecca and just get to know her. And but I was really lucky; she was very candid with me, and a lot of things that aren't in the book, Rebecca shared with me about her life and her, you know, personal life, obviously. And so that I was really spoiled as an actor, just getting all this information about what led to her obsession with these cells that then led to her writing the book.
And Rebecca, you knew that the script was being written, so you kind of had the experience of being turned into a character with the screenwriter, but then is meeting the actor who is you a whole another level?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been involved in the movie from the very beginning. For me, when we did the option for the film, it was really important to me that I and the Lacks family be involved in it. So this was sort of part of the negotiation process with, like, which production company going to go with? Is it going to be major motion picture? HBO had been interested for a long time. And, you know, I went with them for a lot of different reasons. And one of them was that they were willing to make me and several members of the Lacks family consultants. And so I was involved in every version of the script. I would read the different drafts. And by the time, I guess, Rose, by the time you came along, we were on our third screenwriter, George C. Wolfe, who came along at, you know, and he really rewrote the script in some pretty amazing ways and directed it. But yeah, so at that point, we had been through so many years. So with the option, we started in 2010, and I met you
It's 2016.
It was 2016, right.
Wow.
So, so yeah, it was 6 years of working on it. And so, you know, and so by that point, it was, I mean, to have it actually come to fruition in that way, in that moment, was pretty amazing. But also, you know, I adamantly did not want to be in the book.
Mm. In the book at all, not just the movie, but the book itself.
Yeah, I mean, I teach journalism, and I often harp on my students because I have a problem with journalists who insert themselves in other people's stories. And I'm always saying, like, don't insert yourself into somebody's story. You know, this is not about you. And my philosophy about first-person journalism is that unless you are a character in the story, unless mm-hmm. you actually have a role in the story, you should not be there because it can be a distraction and for various reasons. And so I was just like, this is not about me. This is about them. And so many people spent a lot of time trying to convince me that I should be in the book, Deborah Lacks included, my agent, my editors. And at a certain point, I realized that it wasn't about inserting myself into their story. It was that, you know, their story was about so many people had come along wanting something from them, particularly white people, and it hadn't always gone well for them. And I was another one of those people who'd come along wanting something. And along the way, you know, the book's about a lot of different things, but one of them is about ethics of journalism and telling people's stories. And I told the stories of all the other journalists who came along before me in the book and the impact they had on the family. And I realized at a certain point that it would be dishonest to leave myself out and be like, I'm talking about all those other journalists, but not going to mention me that mm-hmm. I was like there for 10 years. But so intentionally, my character in the book is pretty one-dimensional. You don't learn anything about my personal life. You don't learn anything about me that isn't related to Rebecca the journalist, which I felt was really necessary for the book. But for the movie, it's a very different story because you actually have a living, breathing person who is a character. And so during the script development process with each of the different screenwriters, there was always this moment where they went, what do we do with you? Like, what's your narrative arc and who are you and how do you do this? And so I'd been through this and sometimes they would invent a narrative arc and I was like, nope, that doesn't
quite work
for me.
Did you have a romance at any point?
There was potentially maybe, not a romance, but there was insinuation about some things maybe that had happened with some of my editors.
Oh,
and
goodness.
I was like, that's
those
not
are
happening.
Also real people.
Right. Well, but these were like made up editors. But that idea of like, you know, no, I definitely didn't use my feminine wiles to make this happen in any way. But so I'd been through that, you know, in various ways, you know, and so George and I had talked about it and he really wanted to stick with the facts, which is what I very much wanted too. But so, you know, when Rose came along and we met, it was sort of a relief. It really was a relief because it was like, okay, now we can talk about all the things that aren't in the movie, mm-hmm. you know, the things that actually can make this the character, a fully fleshed out character. And I could say, you know, here's what the real Rebecca Skloot wants the movie Rebecca Skloot to sort of reflect. And that meant the world to me. And, you know, Rose just really dove into that. And she, you know, listened to all my tapes with a lot of my audio tapes from my reporting days. And it was exciting. It was so weird. I mean, it is a very weird experience. For, I think for both of us, like for to meet the person who's going to play you, but also to meet the person you're going to play. Like it is a really unusual situation. And so, yeah, it was exciting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you played living real people before?
I had a supporting role in Marie Antoinette, Sofia Coppola's movie mm-hmm. about 10 years ago. And I played Duchess de Polignac, who was a real person, but obviously,
yeah,
had long since passed away.
No Skyping.
No Skyping with the Duchess.
Although she looked like a good time. So yeah, it's a shame she wasn't around. She was a real party girl. Sophia was like, think of Kate Moss. And I was like, okay, I got it. So the answer is no. You know, I've definitely been inspired by people in my life with certain characters I've played. But it's a whole different story when the person's actually there.
What I like about the way you play her, Rebecca, in the movie is that we know the book exists. We know that she had the successful journalistic effort. But in the very beginning, it's really awkward, and you have like you know being dropped off in an alley and not knowing where to go, and like you know, and this clear kind of discomfort as the white woman who's there and the journalist, and like that you kind of put that in there, even though you have the real Rebecca right there as a very professional, competent journalist. Is that hard to kind of add that humor in there and that sense that like it wasn't all smooth sailing at the beginning?
No, well, it's so unusual, this story, because it is such two really unique perspectives on an experience, which is of a young, naive, white journalist, female, and then an older African-American woman from Baltimore. Like it's a very unique story about this incredible thing and tragic thing that happened to her and this thing that she's obsessed with. They're both obsessed with. And I loved it. I dove right in. I loved, those were my favorite things, was shooting that first scene where she walks into the house and meets the family and the pork chop and the whole thing was, it's very unusual and weird. There is a lot of tension and it is really mm-hmm. awkward. And it was really awkward and tense to shoot. I mean, not that tense because John's so lovely and, you know, who played Lawrence. He's so adorable. But yeah, we definitely wanted to capture that. And, you know, she's 27 at the time, not the sophisticated, you know, successful, you know, like I was when I was 27. Yeah. I definitely was not the incredible thing you see today.
One of the amazing things to me about this idea of having this real life character and doing this arc in the movie is that, you know, that was 11 years of my life. So I started out as a very different person than I was when the book was finally over. And you can't really convey that amount of time in this 95-minute movie. So you had to sort of embody the, you know, the emotional kind of, you know, the maturity evolution and the lessons that I learned in life through a much shorter period of time, in a sense, in the movie. And I think it was amazing to me to watch that.
So was it always clear when, I mean, I know the story went through a lot of different versions, but Deborah kind of being the central kind of focus, having kind of a two-hander between you guys, because Henrietta is a major character, but she's, you know, in the flashbacks. I mean, Oprah Winfrey optioned the book. She was obviously a huge part of it from the beginning. But did that seem natural to you in the beginning as a way to kind of hone down this very large sprawling story to make it about a daughter kind of searching for her mother?
I think this was, you know, their focus from the beginning. I think it felt to them like the most natural way to frame the movie. You know, and it's like a road trip. It's a buddy film. You know, it kind of fits into an idea of what we can traditionally see in movies, but then with these flashbacks that make it a much more complicated story. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons why it took me 11 years to write the book. It's one of the reasons why it took 7 years for the movie to happen, is that it's a really complicated story. And I think, you know, there were definitely versions where it was trying to sort of do what the book did, which is weave these different narratives together and not have it be just one central narrative. And there were some that were more heavily on the Henrietta story or the history. And, you know, I had 400 pages to tell all these stories and to go into the science and every bit of Henrietta's life that I could find. And, you know, in a shorter movie, it's much harder to do all that. And they also just, you know, Deborah is this, she was an amazing character. It really was an incredible journey for her. And so I think that was something that they identified from the beginning. That wasn't something I had any sort of involvement with.
Yeah. So it's not just that Deborah and Rika character are kind of like interesting characters and then you get, you know, these incredible intense scenes with Oprah Winfrey, but that you're talking to each other about science and about microbiology and things that like women don't talk to each other about in movies ever. It's just really amazing. I mean, you go in the scenes, you're, you know, Oprah is one of the most famous women in the world. But like what do you reach to on that level where, you know, you're not a microbiologist, so you have to learn that part of it. And then how do you prepare for that huge range of scenes like that opposite someone like Oprah Winfrey?
Well, the science stuff was really intimidating. I failed biology. I'm not, you know.
I did too.
For
different reasons.
Whatever. Don't say that. Jeez. And so that was I was really intimidated by that stuff, most scared, really. And so I just tried my hardest to understand. And, you know, Rebecca's very adept at explaining to a layman like me what scientifically breaking it down so it's not intimidating, and like she did with the Lax family.
I'm
in the same boat. And then just running line, drill, and trying to say it so it doesn't sound like I'm speaking Cantonese to myself, you know, that I could understand what I'm saying. And, you know, you do as best you can. And it's hard. That's why the film's really challenging, because of all that technical stuff. And I think George did a great job of bringing it out and making it visual so the audience can follow. And it's once you do get a handle on it, it's very beautiful. The science behind it is actually really stunning. My favorite scene probably is when they see the cells up on the wall. I think it's really beautiful. And that's what I took away from it, was a really kind of the beauty of science and how incredible it is and just the mystery of it. And
So on a day-to-day basis, when you're on the set, you're kind of watching these scenes go out, like, is it an out-of-body experience? Are you, like, in there to be like, that's not what my muffler looked like? The muffler is a very important part of the story.
The muffler is hilarious. Yeah, the muffler was a big part of the story. The fact that I was driving around in this beat-up car where the muffler had fallen off and that they were sort of embarrassed by that.
It's a really valuable detail, though, because you talk about turning it into a narrative arc. Like, that is part of the story, as you see, you know, where you were and then, you know, where it leads.
Yeah, no, and my role on the set was not that at all. I mean, my role on the set was to sit there and go like, oh my God, this is happening. Like, that was really my job, basically. And it was, you know, I was there, a lot of Lax family members were there, but only a few times. I think we all came to the set maybe, what, 3 or 4 different times.
Oh, okay. So your role as a producer did not play into
I think my role as a producer is more just like, wow, she worked really hard, you know, and I was really involved in the script, sort of consulting on that. And, you know, and I think they just wanted to sort of acknowledge that. But yeah, no, I was not producing in any way. And it was very much on the set. It was like George, the director, and it was the actors. And honestly, one of the things that was so amazing to me as just a regular person visiting a set was the props people and the costume mm-hmm. people, what they did to make the reality, you know, the amount of time they spent figuring out exactly which computer I was using in 1999, mm-hmm. the first time I, you know, and what that car should look like. And yeah, so I mostly just showed up and freaked out and was just like, this is amazing. Cause it was beautiful. And it, you know, I think we all were pretty sensitive about the fact that it would be really weird for Rose for me to just be sitting there while she's shooting these really intense emotional scenes and yeah. having already to worry about all that, but then to worry about the real character sitting there being like, I definitely wouldn't have, like, you know, crossed my arms that way or whatever it was. Yeah. Right. So we were pretty careful about which moments I showed up in.
Yeah.
None of the really high emotion days, you know, the big scenes, like I wasn't there for any of that. But yeah, it was, you know, to see someone else play you is the most amazing. It's one of the most amazing things I think you could sort of see happen to, and but not just to play me, but the whole thing. I mean, there was this one day, I have a little cameo in the movie. I'm the nurse that in 1950 goes and gets Henrietta from the waiting room and takes her back to her first appointment, which is this kind of meta amazing thing for me. But there's this one day where that happened at Hopkins, and we filmed that scene in the room with this famous Jesus statue where mm-hmm, Henrietta mm-hmm. used to visit before her appointments, and also Deborah did. And there were these flashbacks where I was in the room with Renee, who plays Henrietta, in the moments in 1950, and then they'd switch, and then it was Rose and Oprah filming a scene that actually happened in that very room. Mm. And it was the strangest experience because I was in a room that I had been in with Deborah, watching a moment that had happened in that room with someone who was playing me who looked so much more like me in that moment than I did, because I was dressed up as this nurse from 1950. Oh. No one recognized me. I was walking on the set and I was just this anonymous person. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life watching that happen and seeing how time can change in that way in films. And I just got such a tremendous respect for everyone involved in films, the actors, the props, the costumes, the makeup. But the power of seeing that happen, and that was actually the last day of filming, right? And seeing it happen in the room where it happened was so emotional and powerful.
Yeah, I mean, when you're in those, there's a lot of really heavy emotional scenes, and there are moments when you kind of, you know, have big emotions as a character too, but a lot of it is you kind of reacting to other people having these like huge emotional moments. Where do you jump into that and like not just kind of be the observer in the scene? Because mm-hmm. it's, that seems like really hard, because like Rebecca's saying, it's not about Rebecca, but it is about you as an actor.
Mm. I really leaned on George Wolfe, our director. Yeah, I was very conscious of doing too much and doing too little, because it is a tricky role, because she is observing and it's not, it's her story, but it's not her story too. Mm-hmm. It's like, it is this loss of this grief of this woman who's lost her mother and also everything she's done for science. Like, it encompasses a lot. And so I leaned on George a lot, and he loves actors. You know, he's from the theater. He's an iconic theater legend here in New York. And I just leaned on him a lot. And I had so much information from Rebecca with all the great footage of them, audio footage of her interviewing and just hanging out with Deborah. So, you know, armed myself as best I could. And, you know.
What was the best stuff that Rebecca gave you that, like, wasn't in the book and might not even be in the movie, but, like, got you in the headspace of where all that was?
It was terrific. We actually sat down with a really old friend of hers and had lunch in Atlanta. And he was Italian, right? Yeah, what's his name again?
Andreas Garantino.
Okay.
I hope he's
Andreas. And that was really lovely to see someone with an old friend and their body language and hear him and his perspective on her and things that, like, would never be in the movie, but just as an actor to get a perspective on a person outside of this experience was really great. Right, I loved
that. You think about playing a Duchess of Marie Antoinette, who, you know, there's some information about her, but probably not nearly as much as what you can get. Just endless resources.
Endless. And I mean, but in a way, in the end, you have to let it all go.
Yeah.
And just, because I'm never going to be Rebecca.
Yeah.
So I eventually have to like stop that and just do the scene and, you know, everything is informed by the other actor at the end of the day anyway. So
were you part of the casting at all? Because you guys do look alike. Like it's a good match, but you know, because you're an author, like they could have cast really anyone who didn't necessarily look like you.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I was involved to some degree, but not. So when they first started talking about casting, when George came along, and George is this incredible, you know, he's an incredible director. He is this incredible sort of figure in the world of theater. Mm-hmm. And the gift that brought to the story, you know, the movie was, I think, pretty amazing. You know, he came to the the script with, you know, this storytelling perspective that I don't know that someone else from the non-theater world would have necessarily brought. He also thinks a tremendous amount about race in this mm-hmm. country. And I think it was so perfect to have him. And also, like, every actor really wants to work with him. So the actors that he was able to get, even for these
There's amazing
roles,
theater actors in this movie.
They are all so incredible. Like, they're just mm-hmm. every actor is amazing. And, you know, he came to this knowing what he wanted for the mm-hmm. most part and who he wanted. And, you know, and the first time he and I sat down together, he was like, there is this woman called Rose and she must. And he was just so determined.
Like
no,
like
he does. No, he talks like this. He talks very fast and he does like this. He's like, there is this woman named Rose and she looks just like you and she just has to play you and she just feels like you. That is George. Is it not George? Is it George?
But he's a really good impression.
Thank you. I'm sure he'll be very happy to hear that. But then his concern was like, there is this narrative arc of Rebecca. And there is this question of like, you know, where do you cast? Do you cast the young Rebecca or the old Rebecca? Do you cast the middle Rebecca? And how do you play? Mm. And can you play?
So I'm 10 years older than she, you know, I was 37 when we shot this, or 36. And, you know, Rebecca was 27 when she, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. 27.
When
and
she started this.
You know, and so there was then these questions of like, so, you know, how do you, and it wasn't like, is Rose too old for the role? But it was really like, what does this role look like? Mm-hmm, what does this role mm-hmm. need?
There's a naivety
and there's a naivety. Yeah, and it was this question. Yeah. And so there were discussions about, you know, what about this person? Too young. And the whole time, George was like, no, it's Rose. It's Rose. It's Rose. It's Rose. It's Rose. And then it was Rose. I mean, he was so clear on what he wanted and who he wanted for so many things, and he was right about all of it.
I think my favorite of all, you know, this huge amount of casting in terms of small roles is Renee Lee Scoldsberry playing Henrietta, because it's such a huge role, and obviously she won a Tony for Hamilton, and she's kind of famous in a way that a lot of theater actors aren't, because everybody knows Hamilton. And just that, you know, this woman you spent 11 years trying to uncover her story and bring her to the forefront, and then you see her played by somebody.
So
like,
powerful.
What does that like feel like to kind of watch that? Not that it's a culmination of your work, but it's this amazing visibility for this woman who was invisible for so long.
Oh, yeah. No, it's amazing. And Renee just did such an incredible job of embodying the spirit of her that I think we, you know, I and the members of the Lax family really came to understand was her. And, it just makes me cry. Like, every time there's this scene where she's dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the one thing Deborah always, the very first phone call that I had with her, she was very afraid to talk to me because so much had happened to her. She had every reason to not trust me. But she also said, you know, I would love it if a book would be written about my mother, because then the world would know who she was and the incredible contribution she made to science. And she's like, and then maybe I'll know who she was, because she was 2 when her mom died. And she, first phone call, she said, you know, like, what was her favorite color? And did she like to dance? I want to know those things. And part of getting her to trust me was finding the answers to those and bringing them back to her.
Not just about going to the science, but talking about who she was.
No, it was about Henrietta, sure. And both of them, but very much for Deborah, it was about, you know, initially about Henrietta. So the first questions that I sought to answer in order to win Deborah's trust were, did she like to dance? What was her favorite color? And her favorite color is red. And she loved to dance. She would actually sneak out of the house sometimes with her best friend and go dancing. And that scene of Renee dancing in this juke joint in this red dress, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it. It is so gorgeous. And the way she performed that was so powerful. And in that, this is one of those things we talk a lot about, you know, what a book can do that a movie can't, because there's so much more space, but movies can do things that books can't.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment, and a lot of those moments, like, she just embodied her in this beautiful way, and the joy with which she was dancing and the time period it captured, and the fact that in that one little split second moment, that was like 50 years of Deborah's life. She wanted to know, did that happen, right? And like, what did that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's nothing that can compare to the experience of seeing that come to life on the screen. And yeah, every time I cry. Like, I can't not cry when I see that scene. It's just so beautiful. I grin, I laugh, I cry. It's all the cliches, but it's like, it's all really true.
Yeah. And I'm sure you wish Deborah could
see
it.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's the greatest heartbreak about all this, is that she's not here to watch it.
So for people who see the movie, I don't know if they will listen to this after they see it. There's talk about the Henrietta Lacks Foundation. Just like, what's going on with that? What's happening with the foundation now?
So I started the foundation in 2010, and, you know, I came to the decision to do that because as I started to understand the story and what the family had been through, you know, that the cells had been taken without consent, that they had been turned into this, in some ways, multi-billion-dollar product. The family got nothing from that they made all these contributions to science. Everyone in the world benefited and the family suffered a lot. Like all of those things, the more I learned about that, I just said, I don't want to be another person who came along and potentially benefited from that without doing something in return. So Deborah and I had talked about this and I said, you know, I can't pay you for your story because A, I have no money. I'm broke and I paid for this with credit cards and student loans. But you know, if the book ever comes out and if it gets published, I want to start this foundation. So the mission of the foundation and abroad, the broad mission is to help people who made important contributions to science without their consent. So members of the Lacks family are eligible, and so are the descendants of the Tuskegee Syphilis Studies men and a lot of other people, more than we would like to sort of acknowledge in the world that there's a large population of people that qualify. And so to date, we've given out, I think it's like 56 grants to members of just the Lacks family for education, everything from private high school, undergrad, trade school, graduate school. One of her great granddaughters just got her RN. It helps with medical expenses and various other sort of emergency needs. We've given some education grants to the Tuskegee Syphilis Studies descendants. And my hope is that this movie will help spread the word about that and that, you know, some money from the film went into there and my royalties. But my hope is that it will become much bigger than I could ever possibly make it by myself and that it will sort of live on like the HeLa cells and help people, including her family, for a long time to come.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I guess one last question for both of you. Having worked with Oprah, who is a kind of more of an icon than a person to so many people, what do you guys know about her, having worked with her, that is not evident to the rest of us? What blessing have you gotten from making her presence?
She's a considered person. That's what I took away. She really does practice what she preaches. I think she's very meditative on things. She's not an impulsive person in that sense. She's fun and things, but she's quite, you know, considered, I think, and wickedly smart and funny. And, you know, she was quite reserved when we were shooting. She really was conserving her energy, I think. I'd have to ask her, but I respect her process of what she was trying to, because she had a lot on she physically and emotionally, spiritually, what she had to do was a lot. So I totally respect that, of kind of just conserving herself. But she's a very considered, meditative person, I would take away. And she also tells a great story. She's a great raconteur. Oh, occasionally she'd tell me a great story in the trailer. And I'd just
She knows everyone in the world.
I know. She'd tell me like an Obama story, like some great Obama. And I'd be like,
I think they're literally on vacation, like right now, or they were recently.
And, like amazing. You know, I'd just be like, oh, that's right. That's right. I forget. You know, Obama.
I think one of the things that I took from my time with her was, I guess there were two things that really stood out for me. And one was how I saw Oprah, the actor, I mean, you did too, who is very different from Oprah, the television celebrity personality, right? You know, and it was an amazing moment to watch her sit down for the first time with the Lacks family. We had this moment, and Rose was there, when she sat in the room with, I think it was like four or five of Deborah's closest family members to talk about Deborah as a character. Just, this was Oprah, the actor, talking to people who knew her character. And she walked in and she sat down and she said, I am terrified to do this. This is, you know, a really complicated role. You know, I want to do this right. And, you know, she just talked to them about why she was sort of afraid, in a sense, and feeling like this was an enormous task ahead of her, which it was. And I think for all of us, she was very clearly nervous. Like, she really did seem like a person who was pretty nervous about this. And that was really relieving, I think, to all of us. Not that we didn't think that she was would do something like that, but just seeing she really understood the gravity of Deborah's character and the story, and she wanted to do it right and as an actor, and that's a big thing to undertake. And it was an amazing moment because Deborah's sister-in-law, who was like one of her best friends from the time they were 16, was sitting next to her, and she sort of reached over and, you know, she's like, you've got this, and Deborah's got you. Like, you're good. We have total faith in you. And it was one of the most beautiful moments, I think, to really see that. And she worked so hard on the character and to really keep her in mind and also the family in mind, which was an amazing thing to see. And the other thing I saw that was just, I guess, shouldn't have been a surprise, but it was really amazing, was just to see how hard, you know, I mean, I don't know if she would say this, but it struck me how hard it is for her to just go through the world, you know,
as getting being in Oprah.
You know, there's one, the first time we went like downstairs to the restaurant to get tea, you know, we got in the elevator like regular people and went downstairs and it was like, you know, you and just watching the way the world watches her and how graceful she is with that. I mean, she, you know, this millions of selfies and the screaming and the, you know, I was really moved by how patient she was and how she was just like, you know, this is what it is. And Yeah. So I was sort of moved by that in a way that,
maybe being friends with the Obamas teaches you that, like, the spotlight could be brighter.
The grace. Well, and also, I think just the grace. I don't know that her spotlight could be any bigger, honestly.
Yeah. They may be equally famous.
Yeah. And and especially in Baltimore. I mean, she is just such, for, you know, African-American women in Baltimore, she was such an important figure when she first got on television. And seeing that in Baltimore when she was there was really powerful. And just sort of being reminded of, like, where she came from and what she went through to get there and the impact she has on the people around her. That was great to see.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Rebecca Skloot and Rose Byrne, thank you guys so much for, I just like looked at each of you and said your opposite name, which says how much you've merged after watching the movie. Thank you guys so much for coming and talking to me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening, and please keep rating and reviewing us on iTunes and talking to us wherever you can find us. We're all at vanityfair.com, and on Twitter, I'm at Katie Rich, Richard.
Rylaws.
And Mike.
Mike_Hogan.
And we're all at Little Gold Men.
And Joanna's at Joe Wrote This.
Oh, yeah.
I should have done it in the Brando voice.
Oh, yeah. You want to do it again?
Joanna and the Joe Wrote. No, I can't do it. I lost it.
Work on it, and we'll get back to it next week.
Watch a couple holograms. And we'll get you there.
This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the best new version of Emmy campaigning goes to Mike Hogan.
Fair amount of shirtless sort of jogging.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.